Welcome to Daily Kos's The Brief, our weekly show about politics. Here, we'll discuss the issues that are driving the news as we fight for a more progressive America. I am Marcos Omolitsis, the founder of Daily Kos and your co-host, along with senior political writer Carrie Elleveld. If you want to join the conversation, we record the podcast live on YouTube and Facebook every Tuesday at 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern. Enjoy the show. Hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's edition of Daily Kos's The Brief, our weekly show about politics. I'm Marcos Molitsis. I'm here with my co-host, Carrie Elleveld. And we have, it's going to be an interesting show. I mean, we're going to have Mark Elias on the show. He is a superman. He's a superhero. He's a progressive superhero. He's a hero of democracy. He's the guy after the election that, you know, remember when it was like the Trump campaign has lost one out of 25 cases and one out of 40 cases, and one out of 50 cases. That was Mark Elias winning those cases. And even before the election, he was really focused on lawsuits that allowed expanded vote by mail, that allowed longer early voting in a lot of key states. So he is truly somebody that has focused his career, and especially the last few years, on making sure everybody can vote. And we have some important discussions, not just about his efforts, but also why Republicans are so dead set on keeping people from voting. Also, I do want to note that as we tape this, it is Tuesday around 4:30 Eastern. We're about to get the results of the Chauvin trial. And so we are going to, you know, cut in, and we may want to discuss that a little. We will have an episode dedicated next week on the trial and just the state of justice in America. We didn't expect the trial results to come this early. So we wanted to really wait until after we had results. And so we scheduled that for next week. So we will be more focused on that next week as we get a better sense of the outcome. Hopefully it's a good outcome, but either way, there's going to be an aftermath. There's going to be a discussion. There's going to be some kind of reckoning. And so we really want to delve into that next week. But this week, we really are going to focus on the Republican efforts to destroy people's ability to vote, and the you know, quote, the wrong kind of people when it comes to Republicans, because they have basically decided that they can no longer win a majority of the vote. And Kerry, you've really been focused on this recently, and Mark's work actually has informed some of your writing recently, correct?
Well, yeah, I can't wait to get into it with him. But yes, I mean, I was just looking at a blog post he did yesterday. I think it was yesterday. But anyway, this week, called Consent of the Governed. And it really just solidified for me, not that I wasn't aware of this, but just the way he packed it in, you know, the context he gave it, really solidified for me the Republicans' sort of fixation now and dedication to minority rule, and how, you know, after the 2012 election and Mitt Romney's loss, Republicans sort of lamented that they hadn't been they hadn't won the popular vote in five of the last six elections at that point. But after, you know, Trump won in 2016 and still lost the popular vote by several million voters, they started to become this like GOP badge of honor, this mantra that like they didn't have to win the popular vote. And, you know, remember that whole thing about how, well, if you just take California out of it, remember that whole
right.
thing? Like, you know, the California residents, they don't matter. You know what I mean? It's the most populous state of the nation. But it's stunning to think where we are now, especially as Democrats really put forward an incredibly popular agenda under President Biden, with his major initiatives, you know, getting anywhere from 60, you know, two thirds of the country.
So
65.
Carrie, we have Mark in the green room. So we're gonna bring him on. Mark is a partner at Perkins Coie, which is a sort of Democratic super firm, and he's in charge of their election division. And I think Mark might correct me, but I think they have every Democratic senator as a client, possibly, you know, probably, and probably all the party committees. And he was Hillary Clinton's general counsel when she ran for president, John Kerry's. He was Kamala Harris's general counsel this last election cycle. But he also has, he is the founder of Democracy Docket, which is focused on litigation to expand voting rights all over the country. And a lot of the expanded vote by mail, that was his work. And that long string of Democratic defeat, Republican defeat after the election, I think Mark had a hand on every, on pretty much all of those cases. So Mark, it's a distinct pleasure. You're a real hero for democracy. I'm so excited to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So yeah, Harry, you literally just wrote about some of the stuff that Mark was writing about. So I'll let you get, you know, kick things off.
I did. And I think you were in the green room. So you heard a part of what I was saying, Mark. And the one thing that I was just struck by when I was reading your piece is how Democrats have really gone this other direction, right? Where the agenda Biden is putting forward is very popular. You know, COVID relief had some 70% support. Even when you look at the latest infrastructure and jobs plan, many of the prongs of that, you know, particular initiative have in the 70 percentile and above support. And so I think we're looking at a matchup in 2022 and even 2024, where Democrats are really running as a majority rule party. I mean, Biden has redefined what he calls bipartisanship to mean support of Republican voters, not necessarily, you know, GOP Mitch lawmakers. Yeah, not necessarily Mitch McConnell or whatever, you know, the congressional Republicans think. So I drew the conclusion that we could arguably become that in 2022, we could be looking at an election that could arguably become the rawest test of American democracy at the ballot box since the nation's founding. Do you think that's an overstatement of where we stand heading into the next couple election cycles?
I don't. I think that, you know, it's notable until relatively recent. There was a bipartisan understanding in our country of the importance, the rhetorical importance, the moral importance for leaders to claim a mandate, that they represented a majority of Americans. You know, how many times did we hear about how this was a majority center-right country? Because there was a rhetorical power that the Republican Party gained from talking in terms of majoritarianism. And, you know, we saw the breakdown of this around redistricting and gerrymandering, where you could start to see the impulse to, rather than rule through the majority, rule through gerrymandering, be able to rule as a minority. But it has really taken off in the Republican Party now as a historical, an unfortunate historical accident. In 2000, for example, is how I think George Bush would have viewed the fact that he won the Electoral College while losing the popular vote, to now being a normative goal of the Republican Party, which is to use the rules of democracy to allow continued minority rule and to actually allow ever smaller minority to rule the majority of the country. And Biden, you're right, has gone the opposite way. Democrats are now clearly the representing a majority of Americans in Congress, a majority of members, Americans in state legislatures. Joe Biden got 7 million more votes than Donald Trump. So you now have this world in which Democrats are running on the popularity among all Americans of their policies, and Republicans are running essentially on the platform of election rules, suppression and otherwise, that allow them to govern without the consent of the majority.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And it's an interesting point you make about Republicans once upon a time, you know, they really harped on, you know, this being a center-right nation. And you heard that even when the evidence didn't really fit whatever they were arguing for, they would argue it anyway. It was sort of that veneer of credibility, right? It's that cloak of credibility for what they were talking about. And I was, as you said that, I was trying to think, when was the last time I heard a Republican say this is a center-right nation? And I literally can't remember. What do you think at this point they're using, to build a case for their own, you know, existence and credibility? What has replaced We Are a Center Right Nation, if anything?
The only thing that holds the modern Republican Party together, it's not trade, it's not taxes, it's not any of the things that, you know, it's not whether to withdraw from Afghanistan. The only thing that holds the Republican Party together is the need to change voting rules to allow them to continue to govern without majority support. So literally, it is a shrinking party that is trying to figure out how to embrace the least democratic features of our election system, things like the Electoral College, things like the way in which senators are given to states, and then to expand on that to make as hard to vote for Black, Brown, and Young voters and other populations that they think could threaten their ability to maintain power, even though they don't enjoy majority support.
You know, you're in as good a position as anyone to say how well some of these initiatives are going to hold up in the legal system. It's always a losing proposition to try and say where the legal system is going to take us. But if I'm going to ask anyone, I'm going to ask you, if you look at something like the Georgia law or maybe a couple of the other laws coming in Texas, or, you know, I mean, they're sweeping the nation. You're more aware of them than I am. How good a prospect do you think we have of having the courts sort of rein in some of this fervor?
So, look, I think that's the big question right now. I mean, if Congress passes H.R. 1 and the John Lewis Voting Rights Restoration Act, that'll be a huge plus. But in the meantime, as you say, we have state legislatures throughout the country. Already we have seen Georgia pass its law. Iowa before that passed a suppressive law. Montana just yesterday, the governor signed two laws that are aimed at young voters, Native American voters, and others. And we still have Texas, Florida, Arizona, Missouri, New Hampshire, a whole bunch more that are still considering these laws. What I say is that the ideal circumstance is that Congress passes the For the People Act and that state legislatures come to their senses. But ultimately, time and time again, it has been the courts that we have to turn to when fundamental rights are at stake. The right to vote is the right, the Supreme Court said, from which all the rights are preserved. We have to count on courts to do the right thing. That doesn't mean I'm not realistic about the composition of our courts right now, or that I'm overly, you know, that I have rose-colored glasses on, but that's the forum that we have, and it's where we need to take the fight.
Yes, something ahead, very specific to that, because in your blog post, you talked about Justice Scalia. Is that, I mean, the former Justice Scalia? Yeah, and his he I don't know exactly how he worded it, but his sort of proposition that majority, you know, having majority consent was important, I think, is what you were getting at. Can you please just? Do you think that, can you expand on that and tell me whether you think any of those conservative justices are going to look to that type of thinking, or do you get a bad feeling about where they're headed?
Look, I don't know. You know, I can play it both ways. Obviously, it's a 6-3 court right now, that doesn't bode well. Justice Roberts authored the Shelby County decision, which was very detrimental. It's what struck down the covered formula for Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. On the other hand, I point people to the fact that democracy held in the courts after the 2020 election. The Supreme Court didn't step in a way that would have harmed democracy or voting rights. And some of the lower courts, you know, including Trump judges and some conservative judges, did the right thing. So I don't know is the short answer to whether they will see themselves as the guardian, not just of conservative orthodoxy, but the guardian of the Constitution. Because I do worry at some point if you have a persistent attack on democracy and its institutions and its fair administration, coupled with an ever growing gap between the preferences of the majority and who is in power, I worry that the democratic institutions can only hold that so long.
So you mentioned the John Lewis Voting Restoration Act, and
I actually consider that one of the most important critical pieces of legislation this term, and maybe our democracy may hinge upon its passage. Can you, just for listeners and viewers who may not be fully familiar with that piece of legislation, can you talk about how it would make your life easier in protecting people's right to vote?
Yeah. So let me just say a word about H.R. 1, and then I'll talk about that. H.R. 1 for the People Act, S1, sometimes it's referred to, would put minimum guardrails in place for states holding elections. So think about For the People Act as the floor, right? It's saying states, you can't have elections that don't provide these minimum safeguards. What the John Lewis bill does is it restores the coverage formula for Section 5, which was essentially the alarm system for the House, right? So the first sets the floor, but what Section 5 did was that if you're in a jurisdiction with a history of discrimination in voting, you can't change your voting laws without them being reviewed in advance and determined to not make voting harder for minority voters. So we wouldn't have a Georgia law at all because it would never have been pre-cleared. It literally couldn't go into effect until it was pre-cleared, and it never would have been pre-cleared. We wouldn't be facing the kinds of laws we're looking at in Florida, in Texas, in Arizona, because they simply couldn't be pre-cleared. So both bills are very important because one says, look, this is the minimum you need to do. The other simply says you can't make any change, whether it's reflected in H.R. 1 or not. You can't make any change that disadvantages minority voters.
I was just reading your post, and at one point you say, and we've talked about this, but it's just to bring home for readers and listeners, you say in your post, there are no longer serious discussions of how a Republican can win the popular vote in 4 years. Instead, today's GOP is gaming out scenarios where they can lose by more than 7 million votes and still win the Electoral College. And I just think, you know, we went over this, but I think it just bears repeating that this is actually what they're aiming for, is we're going to be able to win the Electoral College and lose by more than 7 million votes,
yeah,
like we did this last time. And I wonder if you hear, if you get up close and personal stuff about that, you know, that you hear from GOP operatives or whatever, is that information that you're coming by, or is it what you're seeing argued in their, in their briefs, et cetera?
It's just the reality of where they are right now. There isn't anyone on any, there isn't a neutral or even a partisan observer of elections who would have said going into 2020 that Donald Trump was going to win the majority of the popular vote. Like, it just wasn't on the table. Like, I don't need to hear it from Republican insiders. It's just no longer on the table. Like, that isn't their strategy. Their strategy isn't to win the popular vote. Their strategy is to find a way to eke out victories without having to win the popular vote. And it's really, really ahistoric. Like, I don't know how more strongly to say it to your audience and to Republicans who are like, well, those are the rules. It just hasn't been the way parties have operated, candidates have operated in this country. Look at George Bush's 2000 victory. And, you know, Marcos, you and I are old enough to have been in the trenches fighting George Bush. You know, both of us. I mean, I'm no apologist for George Bush. I represented John Kerry. I was a strident opponent of George Bush. But George Bush didn't, after 2000, say, oh, good, we figured out a way to win without winning the popular vote. You know, Karl Rove wasn't on TV saying, great, next time we're going to lose the popular vote by even more and still find a way to win.
Or California doesn't matter.
California doesn't matter. I pointed out in that article that I wrote that Bob Dole, who, you know, went on to be Nixon's RNC chair and eventually a senator, well, was a senator at the time, but Nixon's RNC chair and then a presidential candidate, in 1970 said, you know, we all agree that whoever wins the popular vote should be president.
That's crazy. Crazy talk. And you actually talk about Ronald Reagan, patron saint of the Republican Party, who would probably be excommunicated from the Republican Party today. But aside from that, patron saint of the Republican Party, reauthorizing the Voting Rights Act while acknowledging that it would actually be likely to harm him because it empowered groups of people that were not likely to vote Republican. And he didn't care because it was a Democratic ideal and Republicans did adhere to these Democratic ideals. And sometimes it's hard to remember those days, even though they weren't that long ago, right?
No. I mean, and again, I'm not trying to make Ronald Reagan into, you know, good guy, by any stretch of imagination. But he understood, even for the Republican Party's own purposes, to have the rhetorical moral authority he wanted to have, he needed to say that everyone should vote and that the country was a majority of the country was behind him. And the fact that the Republican Party has given that up as an aspiration is, like I said, quite dangerous actually for democracy.
Can you talk about what it was like for you? Because Marcos mentioned at the top how, you know, you were the tweeter who everyone checked to see where we were on the late, you know, on the
card.
Series of right. You were the report card, right? And I literally at the end of the day would go and check your account and you know, especially when I was doing some sort of Friday wrap or whatever and see where we were on the number of losses for Donald Trump and his wayward team. But at the beginning of that, I mean, I think, you know, the elation towards the end and what became kind of a punchline or a joke at the beginning of that, I don't think it was that clear that it was going to come down like that. And can you just talk about that for a second? Because it started to become obvious, but at the beginning, people were saying, gosh, I hope the courts hold. Yeah.
Yeah. No, look, it was terrifying. And, you know, I started Democracy Docket in the spring of 2020, in part because I wanted a platform to say things I wanted to say. And in part because I was getting a lot of questions from reporters about where they could find access to court decisions, because there were a lot of things being litigated. So we started posting the court decisions, and I would tweet out when there was a court decision or something happening. In the post-election period, you know, I was, like everybody else, quite worried that Trump was not going to concede and that the Republican Party would not have the wherewithal to tell him to, which turned out to be true, and that, you know, we would get mired in endless court fights. And who knows where the Supreme Court or where the courts would be. But I kept posting the court decisions. So we kept up the discipline on Democracy Docket of whenever there was a case that was filed, we would post the lawsuit. Wherever there was, you know, whatever briefs were filed, we'd post them. And then when there was a decision, we'd post them, I'd tweet it out. And it became clear over time, people were following me simply to know what was happening with these court decisions. So then I figured, okay, well, I might as well tally them up. So I started then keeping a running count of how many there were. But, you know, but underneath that, which, as you said, became a bit of kind of a punchline of how badly the Trump and his legal team was doing, underneath that was really an effort to educate people so that they didn't believe the lies. Because one of the things we saw was that lawyers lied a lot in the parking lots, even when they weren't repeating those things in the courtrooms. And so by posting the transcripts, posting the court decisions, and then tweeting about it, I felt like I was also helping educate people about what was really happening in those courtrooms. And they could read them for themselves. They didn't need to listen to what the news said. They could actually see those underlying documents.
Yeah, Mark, I think it was fantastically effective, not just as an information tool, but also as a narrative setting tool. I mean, it was very easy for the media to look at that and go, oh, you know, Republicans are 1 for 30. And that one really annoys me. And that's the case the Supreme Court just dismissed from.
No, it isn't the case.
Oh, it isn't. That was a different one.
So it's funny you say this.
Tell us about that one.
I will tell you about the one, but it's really interesting. Progressives are annoyed about the one. I thought the one was okay because I thought it actually gave it a greater sense of authenticity. I mean, the truth is, I could have said it was zero because I'm going to describe the one and it's a little bit charitable to them. But But I thought, like, okay, like, let's give them their due. Let's publish the one. Let's note the one. But man, did I get a lot of Twitter hate when I did that. People were arguing with me about whether or not they deserve the one. So here is the one. Pennsylvania has a law that says that if you are a first-time voter by mail, actually based on federal law, if you're a first-time voter by mail, you have to, and you registered by mail, you have to provide ID. Okay. And so the question was, how long after the election, if you were a first-time voter by mail who registered by mail, in other words, the first time you voted was by mail, not that it was the first time you voted by mail, but that it was the first time you voted at all. If you had done that and you had not included the ID with your absentee ballot, how many days after the election could you show up and provide your ID? So this involved a very, very small pool of people to begin with. These are people who they had never voted before. The first time they voted was by mail, and they had not provided ID. The Commonwealth had said that people had 9 days. Okay. The Trump campaign sued to say, no, no, it's actually 7 days. And they won. Now, I'm not sure that anyone actually showed up on day 8 or 9, because think about it, right? Like by day 8 or 9, like kind of like if you were in this narrow class, you probably were showing up the day or two after the election. By the time you get a week out, not likely a lot of new people are showing up, but they shortened the period from 9 days to 7 days. So I counted that as a win.
Yeah. Yeah. As okay.
Amazing, very narrow. According to Trump, that was a huge, huge, huge win. Huge.
Yeah. The case in the Supreme Court that you just saw, they had lost already. They had lost that in the Third Circuit. So what the Supreme Court did was dismiss the appeal. But they had lost that case in the Third Circuit.
All right. I'm still annoyed at that one. But I totally understand the power it had in setting that narrative as well, because it showed that you were willing to be fair about the one narrow victory that Republicans had. Terry, I think we only have them for a couple more minutes, so go ahead.
Can I ask a quick question about the media? No. You know, it's obviously you didn't get into this for media attention. It just found you, and for good reason. And I wonder if you think now that there's something you wish the media was focusing on that it isn't in the mess of things that are coming.
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked that question. I wish they were not just focused on purple states. You know, the fact is the Iowa law is every bit as suppressive as the Georgia law. The Montana law is every bit as bad as the Georgia law. But the narrative that the media wants to tell is a simple one about fighting over one place, when in fact what we really have is an avalanche of this throughout the country. So I feel like the media is missing the big picture and really just wanting to tell that small thing. If I can just add one thing, because I know I'm running out of time.
No, and I'm going to ask you, actually, we have time. respectful of your time. So the Daily Coast is a community of activists and people who do stuff. So I want to give you an opportunity to tell our listeners and readers what they can do to help you in the work that you're doing in protecting our democracy.
So I'm glad you asked, because that's actually leads into what I wanted to say. So undoubtedly, some of your viewers know this, but some of your viewers are probably quite a bit younger. People like me and Democracy Docket only exist because of the work that you did. The Daily Coast, before there was a Democracy Docket or any of this, there was Daily Coast. And Daily Coast was a place where people could stand up in the town square, the new town square of the internet, and speak out and say, this is not okay. You know, the stuff that we're seeing our government do, the stuff we see George Bush doing, it's not okay. And it's hard for people to appreciate how revolutionary that was to the movement, to the progressive movement, to the Democratic Party. So I want to, first of all, thank you for that, because I feel like you are the pioneer that made so much of the rest of us able to speak out in our own online forums.
That is so incredibly kind. I really appreciate that.
But it's also, though, a message of what people can do today. Stand up and speak out. Don't just be quiet. Tell your friends, your neighbors, your colleagues, your clients, your uncle who is a Trump supporter, tell them it's not okay. That's what Daily Coast did. It still does. But that's how progressives formed around formed a community. God, two decades ago.
We're old.
And it is where the power remains. So for some of you, that forum of standing up in the town square is literally going to be like, you know, calling your friends or doing a Zoom. For others, it will be posting online. For others, it'll be writing your senators. But being heard and being heard as part of a community is what is going to defeat the anti-majoritarian efforts on the other side. It is by being quiet that we will lose. So I just wanted to end by thanking you for that, because I really do think you're responsible for so much of where progressives are right now.
Thank you so much. Truly appreciate that from the bottom of my heart. And your work is inspiring and so necessary. And I'm so glad we have you on our side and not on their side.
Absolutely.
So thank you so, so very much. Appreciate your time. And thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Wow. And we're going to be sending that $20 check to him very soon, too, because for that plug for you. I don't know. I think we should send him 50.
Oh, I did not negotiate rates for endorsements.
I know you did not. But he makes that's such a good point. And I mean, you know, we write for a living, right? But God, if there was one thing that I learned from covering the LGBTQ movement is that it's at some point people just believe in it enough that they stand up and say, this isn't okay anymore. I mean, that's what LGBTQ activists finally did with the Democratic Party. It's not okay anymore for you to say you're our friends behind closed doors and then not act on our issues when you're in power. And so, you know, the power of people standing up and saying, this isn't okay, this isn't true, is so important and takes a lot of guts in your personal life. It takes a lot of guts and energy. So it's not, you know, it's not easy. It doesn't come easy.
You know, there's a bit of a dichotomy when you're looking at these voter suppression efforts by Republicans, right? And one is that we've seen in certain places that when people are told you can't vote, it actually energizes them. And because it gives a sense of, well, why are you afraid of our vote? I guess it actually does matter. And it can actually work to overcome those efforts. But then there's a reality that there shouldn't be any overcoming that needs to happen.
Voting, it's morally repugnant
and Republicans act like, you know, there can be zero restrictions on, let's say, gun ownership, right, on the Fourth Amendment, when the amendment literally says well regulated. The amendment literally has the word regulation in it. Mm-hmm. But they act like, you know, heaven forbid you're even asked to show an ID to buy a gun, you should be able to go to a gun show. But when it comes to voting, which is literally the bedrock of democracy, it is the bedrock of the Constitution, they suddenly get the vapors at the idea of people voting. And every year we see it. There are voter fraud cases. You could probably count them on two hands. And they're always Republicans because they're always projecting, right? They think, well, liberals are getting away with it, then I'm going to do it. And then it turns out that nobody's getting away with it and they get caught. But the reason I say this is I don't want to sort of create this sense of like we're doomed because Republicans are doing this in Georgia, in Texas. We're not doomed. It means we have to work harder, and it's exhausting because they know this. They are more likely to vote. Their core constituencies, which are older, wealthier white people, are more likely to vote than younger, browner, and single people.
I'm going to go. It's true. Okay. And that's what they're aimed at. But let me go ahead and offer a note of hope to what you're saying, which is I'm not convinced that they're going to be able to keep the constituency that they think that they're targeting. So, you know, they're not offering any policy and agendas anymore. They're only offering grievance politics, lifestyle. It's a lifestyle brand, as someone at the Bulwark wrote. And I don't know that a lifestyle brand of voter suppression and grievance and anger and, you know, lashing out at corporations and whatever is really going to get that dependable, wealthy vote that they used to be able to count on. So I think, it's, you know, they could end up sort of sabotaging themselves by going down this path. And I just want to be clear that, you know, everybody thinks that because the historical norm is if you are the party that controls the White House and you, and especially if you control both chambers of Congress too, you're going to lose a lot of, you're going to lose a lot of seats and potentially one, you know, most likely the historical preference is
yeah, it's happened in every, one, except right. George Bush after 9/11, which was a very right. historical moment.
Right. Very. And I just think that we are in a very ahistorical moment. That doesn't mean I know which way it's going to go. It just means that the GOP base is a floater right now. You don't even they don't even know what they're aiming at anymore. And on top of that, you know, I think that the Democratic Party has really found its voice. It's frankly been freed up from having to respond to the nonsense of the Republican Party. And if you just look at Georgia alone, the ahistorical nature of two Democratic senators being voted in a runoff election, that was completely ahistorical in a runoff election for Democrats in Georgia.
To keep Democrats from voting, absolutely. And especially specifically to keep Black candidates from voting statewide, from winning statewide. Right. And it's exactly what we got.
Right.
So I actually think you're right. There's another interesting wrinkle that I'm starting to formulate, and it's not fully formed, but we know that Democrats won in a landslide in 2018. 2020 was tighter because of this hidden Trump vote. It doesn't turn out when Trump is not on the ballot. They needed that to make it close. Mm-hmm. This is not part of that base that turns out hell or high water. That's not right. your typical conservative, church-going, rural, older Americans. This is as hard to turn out, if not harder to turn out, than core Democratic constituencies, right? So if you're suppressing the vote, say, in Texas, you may actually be suppressing that Trump vote. Maybe they don't come out after all. Who knows, right? We still don't have a big enough sample size. They didn't turn out in big numbers in the Georgia runoff. But what happens, I mean, some of them did though. Some of them did, just because you see the increase in vote from 2016 in the 2020 runoff, right? But what happens if you end up, you know, you piss off liberals, they do what they need to do. You know, they may suppress some of us, but not all of us. But you also suppress that core Trump vote even more. So we have breaking news, Carrie.
We sure do.
Good news. It's good news. In the Chauvin trial, he is guilty of all three charges. Two of them are unintentional murder.
Second-degree unintentional murder.
Yeah, and then also guilty of what? One charge of third-degree murder?
Yep.
Which is, oh, no, third-degree murder and then second-degree manslaughter. Either way, three charges. He faces up to 40 years in total.
40 years.
So
40 years. He faces up to 40 years in prison for the second-degree murder, up to 25 years for the third-degree murder, and up to 10 years for the second-degree manslaughter charge. So all said and done, he could face up to 75 years. Not that my math is that great, but I think that's what we're looking at.
So, Carrie, you know, it sucks. It really sucks that the response to this is sort of relief that in this one instance, out of thousands, justice was served.
Right.
This should have been a given, right? Nobody should have been worried. A no-brainer.
Right. Yeah, the nation, right. I mean, we came into this, we knew the verdict was going to be coming down probably in the middle of this podcast of this episode. And, you know, we were really on edge, right, as the nation was, about what this verdict was going to bring. And although it brings, you know, a sense of relief that at least this guy who, you know, murdered a man and brought a Black man in broad daylight in front of a bunch of people that he traumatized, an entire community of people that he traumatized while he was doing it, you know, is going to be held accountable. There's that relief, but also the sense that this doesn't necessarily prevent this from happening again, as we know. And there's nothing that brings George right. It's happened during the entire
in Minneapolis
trial
during the trial
in Minneapolis, And there's nothing that brings George Floyd back to his family, to his little girl, just like there's nothing that brings back, you know, Dante Wright or, you know, any of these other folks who've even just recently died at the hands of law enforcement officials. So, you know, it is like a momentary sigh of relief. And then.
But that's it. It's not a
victory. We got it. It's not. There's not. It's not. And, you know, we are going to cover this in next week. Episode next week. And we can talk about, too, some of the victories of police reforms that are happening at the state and local level. But obviously more needs to be done because there's no end to this wave. And if there's anything we can hope, it's that having someone be held accountable, which historically almost never happens with police officers, right? Having someone be held accountable will at least hopefully register in the back of the minds of police officers moving forward who might be deciding whether they're going to escalate a situation or try to de-escalate it so they don't get into a situation where they're drawing a gun or going for a taser or whatever they're doing.
Yeah, they're drawing the gun too much, and that's a big chunk of the problem. And you would think, I thought once police were required to have body cameras, I thought that would change behavior. But it's become very clear that culture is a culture where they think that what they're doing is righteous, that it's justified, and that they can do so in impunity, that they could literally murder in impunity. And so that clearly needs to be tested.
And they're trained to escalate in every situation. You know, I can't say this for every law enforcement, entity across the nation, but the vast majority of police officers are trained to escalate, right? Yeah. Most of them are not trained in de-escalation, which is a huge part of the problem.
Yeah, and I think just to I definitely don't want to minimize that issue. We really are going to focus it on it next week, but it sort of ties in to the conversation we were having about voting rights, because just like the runoff law in Georgia was specifically designed to keep Black candidates from winning statewide, and before, during Reconstruction, there was you know, a lot of Black senators from Southern states, and Jim, you know, once the Union soldiers pulled out and Jim Crow laws came into effect, they were specifically designed, and nothing has changed in those years since. And they know that our disadvantaged communities are some of the lowest performing. So you don't need to add that many voting restrictions to make it even harder for those people, less likely for those people to turn out and vote. And I think it's all part of this institutionalized system of racism that has been sort of enacted in this country. And it shows up in policing, it shows up in hiring and corporate America, it shows up in depictions in the media, it shows up in our most, you know, cherished rights, which is to vote. And it even shows up in the gun debate. We saw, I don't know if you saw, Carrie, but last week a Army lieutenant was driving in Virginia, got pulled over, was pepper sprayed for nothing. Nothing. Yeah. I mean, the cop claimed that there was no license plate, but there was a new vehicle tag right in the back, you know, window, and you could see it in the body cam footage. He didn't care. He didn't care that there was body cam footage. Once again, this was a uniformed member of our armed forces. He was Black. And it turns out, believe it or not, a member of the U.S. Armed Forces had a gun in the car. And the right wing tried to use that to justify why this guy needed to be harassed because he had a gun. And suddenly, I guess. So even having a gun as a Black man suddenly is you know, it's unallowed by this racist right wing. And so,
yeah,
their
precious right of gun ownership is to be denied, you know, to other people. I mean, you know, if you're not white, you don't get to, then the precious Second Amendment right isn't good for you. I mean,
remember that picture of the Black Panther Party, you know? It just terrifies them. A Black man with a rifle?
Yeah.
It might be the scariest thing for the conservative.
And I will add, in the situation that you were just talking about, it was kind of unbelievable to hear the incident, the pepper spray incident, right, with the army.
Yeah, right.
So the supervisor of that squad, or that I think, you know, in particular, the officer who pepper sprayed, was saying that they weren't going to, he probably wouldn't have done anything about it. He wouldn't have put that person on leave. He wouldn't have reviewed, you know, the situation, except that the body cam footage became public. And then, you know, after the outcry, he was like, oh, I think I got a problem here. I mean, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but he literally said during a press conference, you know, that he hadn't considered disciplinary action until the outcry over the body cam footage. So, I mean, the body cam footage has not done everything right that we wanted it to do, but at the very least, once it becomes public, in the situation most recently in Chicago, they publicized that body cam footage. They showed it to the victim's family, very soon after it happened. Whereas, you know, before, in the case, I think, of Laquan McDonald, they held it for over a year or something like that. So it's, the body cam footage is coming out faster, typically, and it is helping to bring law enforcement officials to their senses that they can't just ignore stuff like this, and that it's like part of the normal course of action. I mean,
it's not enough. What is the equivalent in voting rights? Because let's just say Republicans, they're wearing that body cam footage. We're seeing them in public specifically and unambiguously make it harder for people to vote. And they will even say so in their committee hearings and in law, you know, in legal cases. They'll say, like, yeah, if we don't do this, we're going to lose. There's more Democrats. We cannot survive as a party if these people vote. They don't think, how do we get them to vote for us? That doesn't even remotely enter the equation. And one thing that you have written about a lot, and so have I actually, is that this is one of the reasons that college-educated suburban voters are trending away from the Republican Party. So maybe that's the catch. People that are horrified. And, you know, Mark Elias talked about Ronald Reagan. Maybe I brought it up, but he wrote about Ronald Reagan actually signing the Voting Rights Act extension, even acknowledging when he did so that it hurt him. But maybe it didn't hurt him because it sent a signal to educated white voters that he wasn't racist. Well, he couldn't be racist. He just voted for this, right? And that was why Republicans for the longest time used dog whistles, right? This coded language that said, you know, don't worry, we're racist like you. We're just not going to, you know, declare it with a trumpet and fanfare and let everybody know, right? We're going to, you know, wink, wink. And they've abandoned that. And as they abandoned that, they've also started losing that, you know, college-educated suburban white vote. So that might be the comeuppance. But I know you've been writing a lot about that. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I think the Republicans have sort of lost the plot here. I mean, if you look at what they're doing, right, they seem to think that they can shift entirely and go after this Trump vote, you know, that wants overt racism. The Trump voter wants overt racism. They want lashing out. They want all this stuff. They seem to think that they can go after that vote by sort of morphing into Trump, right? By lashing out at corporations, by courting Trump down, you know, going down to Mar-a-Lago and sort of kissing the ring.
Giving
him fake awards, right? Made up awards. Here, congratulations. We've never given this before, but it's very prestigious. So
we'll get it every year too. Right. Surprise! Right. You win
You'll
again.
You'll get it next year too. So, oh my God, what a loser. So anyway, but, you know, I think that they think that they can go down this path without disrupting their connection to, you know, to the wealthy voters and donors who have typically supported in the past. And I don't think you can make the sort of turn that they're making. It's like it's not quite 180 degrees, but it is a sharp, you know, is a sharp right or left turn or whatever. It's a sharp right turn, I guess is what it is. And not have it disrupt who you're aiming at. Like, you can't target the same people when they do what they're doing so overtly. And they seem to think they can, you know, they seem to think that they can have it both ways. Oh, you know, we'll lash out at the corporations on one hand, but then when Biden says, hey, we're going to do an infrastructure and jobs plan, and part of the way we're going to fund it is by raising the corporate tax rates, well, then we're going to pretend that we're besties of corporations, and we should pretend that Democrats are much scarier proposition to corporations than Republicans are, when you don't know whether it's going to be Ron DeSantis on one day, Ted Cruz on the next day, or Mitch McConnell on the next day, who's taking a swipe at you, right? I mean, they're trying to say that Democrats are more scary because they want a several point corporate tax rate raise.
Which is still lower than it was when
still lower Trump than it was. And it's office. And Biden is stable. He's a stable individual. He's not taking swipes at corporations randomly out while he's talking. I mean, it just they think that they get to have their cake and eat it too. And I just don't think that's possible. There's no way they can go down this path without sacrificing some of the very stable voters that they've had in the past.
There was a poll recently, I forget who made it. It was kind of a funny poll, and it asked people, if a time machine was invented, would you go back in time or would you go forward in time? And literally what you found is that progressives were like, get us to the, let's get, if things are getting better, let's go there. Let's go to the future. And conservatives wanted to go to the past, right? And I think a big chunk of that is a world where Asian people and Latinos and Black people weren't in their neighborhoods and weren't on their TV and probably weren't influencing corporate America. I mean, corporate America has made a very calculated decision right now that they are not going to enable the racism of the Republican Party. And so if you look at Fox News advertisers, and you're stuck with the Mike Lindells, right? The crank two-bit players. And that's what's left. And so corporate America is sort of, I don't think they want to walk away from the Republican Party. They wish they had a sane party that would actually work to keep their taxes low and that of their, you know, billionaire CEOs. But they now realize that on the other hand, you have the mass of consumers that is becoming increasingly diverse, and America's headed towards majority minority status in the next couple of decades. And
the
may
people
look,
who work for them. The people, it's
and,
not just
yeah,
consumers.
Right.
It's the, you know, it's, hey, we've got to recruit competitively, and we're recruiting among a very diverse pool of people that include people of color, that include lots of women, that include LGBTQ folks. Yep. You know, so they have to be competitive, not just in the consumer market, but also in the recruiting market. And that becomes a real problem for them if they're, you know, if they can't get talent.
So, and right, young people may not vote, but they buy stuff, right? They set the culture, right? They decide what's cool and what's you know, what people should consume, and it matters. So you have this Republican Party that has inexplicably cast its lot with this sort of dying part of America. And yes, they are conservative, and that word actually means something, but it's been stripped of all ideology to really at this point mean just the clinging to dying white culture. I mean, that's really the essence. And so you see it in policing, you see it in the voting rights work that Mark Elias is doing. And that's all that is left. And those people are dying off. Their kids are far more likely to be liberal, even in conservative states like the South. There is a reckoning they need to do. And I don't understand why they cling to a Donald Trump that has literally become almost irrelevant overnight. You take him off Twitter, and Carrie, I never thought Twitter was as powerful as I realize now, that almost all his power was because of freaking Twitter. And you take that away, and if you were to ignore him, he'd be like the crazy uncle and in the background just ranting away and nobody would pay attention. But he has no way to reach people right now. And even if you look at conservatives, I mean, looking at civics numbers, his popularity is just kind of on a slow downward trajectory. And it's only why would he become relevant? I think he's done, and they are keeping him alive for some bizarre reason to get those people that they're probably suppressing with their voter suppression laws.
Look, I mean, they really, they are all over the map. And this goes back to that interview that we finally got with Sarah Longwell, where, you know, and she's she was GOP strategist and publisher of The Bulwark and whatever. And what she said was, you know, you ask Republicans about 2020 and they'll say that, you know, well, Trump got 75 million voters. She said it's really 74 million, but they're just so thrilled with 75 million. They can't believe that 74 million actually like came out and voted for them, that they just are keep saying it over and over again, like it's a mantra, right? And so that's why they've gotten into this like tizzy about how we're going to keep those voters. I mean, it could be that no one keeps as many voters as we got in 2020. It could be that the ease of getting to the voting booth or of sending in, you know, a voting absentee ballot or whatever in sort of unprecedented times, we might have a historical moment there where more voters turned out than will ever turn out again for a while. Who knows? But they're just, it's so important to them to try and get back to that high watermark that Trump set, that they're like burning down everything else to get back there. And, you know, I can't figure out what the heck they're doing. And part of the problem is too, there's no fresh voices among them to do anything creative and innovative in order to try and get new voters, right? They're like following after Trump, like, you know, like lap dogs, and they're literally morphing Lemmings. Into him in his absence, right? As he recedes from the stage, they are becoming him. Mitch McConnell lashing out at corporations and saying they could invite serious consequences if they don't sort of shut their trap and just keep donating, right? Was an unbelievable moment for me where I thought, oh my gosh, he is becoming Donald Trump before our very eyes. And of course, he came back and walked it back. But the idea that those words even came out of Mitch McConnell's mouth was just unbelievable. And in Trump's absence, they are having to go, you know, sort of go like shrink to the levels that he always was, the low levels that he always was, in order to attract that base back. They are having to become Trump in order to try to keep that base, you know, engaged, interested, et cetera. And if Trump isn't doing it for them, they have to do it themselves. And they're literally becoming him in the process.
Yeah. And in the end, what they're trying to do is they're trying to keep our low propensity voters from turning out while getting their low propensity voters
right
to turn out. And, you know, I don't know how that's a winning strategy. I don't think it's looking that way. I guess we'll find out next year. I mean, this election is going to be upon us sooner than we think, but and we've been writing about it, I think it's going to be rough for the Republican Party, given the popularity right now, not just of Biden himself, but also of all the legislation that's passing. So, Carrie, that's all the time we have this week. Thank you for listening. If you're enjoying the show, be sure to subscribe and give us a rating wherever you get your podcasts. You can always talk to us at dailycoast.com or on Twitter at dailycoast. I'd like to thank Mark Elias for joining us. Carrie, so thanks so much for being my co-host. Walter Einenkel for being our producer. Thank you, the listener and the viewer, for joining us in this discussion. Thank you so much for all the work that you do and work that you're doing to save our democracy. Everybody, have a great day. See you all next week when we're going to have this, I think, difficult conversation about the state of race relations and justice in America. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening. If you're enjoying the show, give us a rating wherever you get your podcast. You can always talk to us at dailycoast.com or on Twitter at dailycoast. See you next week.